You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey everybody, welcome to our first Q&A session. As a lot of you may know, on the Bible for Normal People website, we have an Ask Pete section, and people can submit their question. People like you, normal people, can submit their questions, and we're going to get to them in one way or another. We can't promise we get to all of them, but we're going to get to a lot of them, either in Q&A sessions like this as a podcast, or sometimes devote an entire podcast to some of the bigger issues or things like that, because we value your questions and we want to talk about what you're interested in talking about.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do. We're going to answer questions.
Yeah.
And it's going to be great.
Oh, Jared, wake up.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey, Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Eine Barra ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Le
Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
All right. So anyway, yeah, we have a bunch of questions. We've only had this up for a while, and we just picked some that we thought might be easier to answer in a short period of time because we're sort of new at this. But we're going to get to some other questions that are a bit longer and very interesting. But for today, we're going to just sort of hit some questions like the following from somebody who prefers to remain anonymous, which is fine. But here's the basic issue. He has come across passages in the Bible that he feels are platitudes, and they're used that way as platitudes, and they just don't match his experience. And so he asks the question, how do we handle a Bible that lies to us? And I've heard that before. What do you think, Jared?
Yeah, I think it'll be, you know, he gives a few specific examples that'll be fun to walk through here. First of all, I don't know if we should have identified that it's a he, because we may have outed him. I mean, it really narrows it down when we use he. But he uses specifically the verse, God has plans for you. He paraphrases it. It says, God has plans for you to have a super fantastic life. That's how he read that verse. And I can do all things through Christ. So he read those and it didn't match his experience in terms of what happens when your life doesn't seem all that great. Is that God's plan for you? And is that fantastic? And can we do all things through Christ? And so, I mean, I think we should wrestle with the particularities of those verses, but then that bigger question of what do we do with a Bible that lies to us? And is that a fair statement to put on the Bible or is it not a fair statement? So you can tackle it from whatever side.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, the Bible that lies to us, I get the point. I understand the sentiment behind it, but I think that comes more from false expectations about what the Bible is prepared to do, because we're taught that, you know, this is God's letter to you, and, you know, this whole Bible is God speaking to you directly, and anything here is applies to you. And you've got the added issue, like Jared just mentioned, that, well, what do these passages even mean, you know, in some sort of a context? But then, more importantly, even if you know what they mean, does that mean they transfer into your life sort of automatically without a moment's reflection? And I think that's to me, a fundamentally misguided way of thinking about the Bible, that it's just sort of transferable to your moment. You know, when he thinks, I can do all things through Christ, you know, that's a common passage that people talk about.
Well, can I rant? Yeah. I want to rant on that one for a minute, because that's just one that I think is so easily misunderstood, and it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So I'm sure right now the World Cup is going on, and I'm sure there are at least 100 players that have Philippians 4:13 somewhere on a jersey or on a shoe or something. And it's become this mantra of overcoming. So it's become part of this kind of overcoming mentality. You can do all things. So when you're like working out, you're just thinking, I can do all things. But just looking at the Bible in Philippians 4 and what Paul's talking about, it's clearly not about like accomplishing life goals or winning competitions, but it's in the context of contentment. He says, I've learned the secret of being content, whether I'm well fed or hungry, living in plenty or in want, I can do all things. And also, if you, in the original language, the verb there, do, isn't actually there. So we supply that to make sense of it. But given the context, I think the verb probably shouldn't be do, but should be content. given the context. So just even a plain reading, when I just look at the context of Philippians 4, I would actually read that as saying, I can be content in all things through Christ who strengthens me. So anyway, that's just my rant, as I think we've maybe taken that in a direction that Paul was not intending.
Yeah, it's almost a bit of a lazy reading, and you know, I don't say that too negatively, because I think many of us do lazy readings of the Bible all the time. But you know, it doesn't really mean that, and then these passages become sort of just ways of baptizing your own desires, your own wants. And also it's obviously misleading, because, you know, you can do all things through, what does all things even mean, right? So it's a matter, like Jared said, it's a matter of looking at the context a bit to seeing what it means. But I think more importantly, you have to do the harder work, the theological work of thinking through what it means to sort of apply the Bible to your life. And, you know, Paul is writing letters to people at certain times and places for certain reasons. And I don't think it's a strong reading of the Bible to simply, you know, think of our own context as being similar or equal to that. We have to do the work. And that's the hard part. We have to do the work of really discerning whether the situation I find myself in is comparable, let's say, to whatever Paul is talking about in that letter. And, you know, that doesn't mean the Bible can't be used for your life, but it just means it takes hard work to do that. You can't just look at a verse and say, oh, gosh. And plus, that makes people like this male feel really bad about himself, you know, because the Bible says this, and I don't see this in my experience at all. This is not what happens. And I think most people say, yeah, that doesn't happen. And so he concludes, well, the Bible's lying to me. Now what do I do?
Mm-hmm. So what I hear you saying is, what I hear both of us saying, I think when I talk about Philippians 4 and understanding these verses maybe a little bit in context, there's the hard work of actually trying to see how this fits into what the original author, Paul, or anyone else is trying to say. But then we can't even stop there. What I hear you saying is then there's this extra work that has to be done when we then say, okay, I know what Paul was intending to say in that context, but is my context comparable or is it different? And does that change how I apply this? Would that be a fair way of saying that?
Yeah, I think so. And that keeps us from saying things like whether God lies to us or not. It's a matter of not a matter of lying, because maybe God's not even talking to us, so to speak, right there. That doesn't mean you can't apply this to your life again. But I think we short-circuit a necessary process by simply looking at these passages and saying they are speaking to me directly. They may be speaking to you indirectly, but you have to almost earn the right to get there, right? And again, that sounds discouraging to many people, I'm sure, because it's like, well, this is the Bible. This is my guide for life. Okay, that's fine, but that doesn't mean it doesn't take a lot of work. And the evidence for that is over 2,000 years of Jewish and Christian schools of interpretation that have taken a lot of time thinking through the Bible and what it means. It's actually not an easy book. It's actually not that straightforward at times, and you really have to think about what's going on here and what does this mean for my situation right now.
Well, I think that actually segues really well into the second question from Zach Zimbelman. We're going to maybe butcher these
names.
We're
going to butcher some of these names.
So apologies, many apologies to you, but we're going to give it our best shot. So Zach asks about recommending a good study Bible, and I think that's a good question of, okay, you're saying it takes all this work. Well, what are some tools and resources that are available that might help us do some of this work? So what have you ran across?
Well, I love this question because, you know, a lot of people ask it, and I think a good study Bible is a fantastic way of getting on board with, you know, maybe answering difficult questions or expanding our knowledge and, you know, just basically finding out things about context, about history, and about all sorts of things. And, you know, for those of you who might not be familiar with it, a study Bible is basically a Bible that has several things in it. It usually has footnotes at the bottom that explain concepts or gives you other sorts of information. And it has maps and charts. And good study Bibles have essays in them that really help explain a lot of things. The ones that I recommend, I think there are several good ones out there, but the ones that I recommend are the Interpreter Study Bible, which is for the New Revised Standard Version. Also, the HarperCollins Study Bible, which is likewise the New Revised Standard Version. And then for the Old Testament, the Jewish Study Bible. And there's also a New Testament Study Bible written by Jewish scholars called Jewish Annotated New Testament.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I should know that because I use it all the time.
Well, it has, Mark...
Mark Brettler and Adele, no, and Amy Gillivine.
Yeah. Two of our guests.
Yes,
exactly. Have done that.
We should prepare for these podcasts better.
Yeah, we should have... Well, we got to... If you haven't already, maybe if you support us on Patreon, we could hire like a fact checker... Someone to do all this work for us.
Or just someone to actually do the podcast.
Just hire new hosts who do the homework.
Yeah, that's good.
No, I'm getting old. My brain's tired. But, you know.
It's the annotated Jewish New Testament, right?
I think it's a Jewish annotated New Testament.
Okay. Well, it's some combination. Yeah, if you like Google that, those four words, you'll find it. And it's Mark Brettler and Amy Gillivine.
And that is also the new Revised Standard Version. The Jewish Study Bible is not. That is a translation from the Jewish Publication Society, which probably might take some getting used to for people. But what I love about those study Bibles is that they're not, one thing is that I think you can trust them to give sort of mainstream, well-recognized explanations for difficulties. Other study Bibles, and I don't want to like draw these lines here on the podcast and sound belligerent. I really don't mean that, but in my experience, the more conservative study Bibles tend to be more apologetic. They're trying to defend something.
Certain readings.
And I find that's not helpful because people are sometimes looking at these notes and they want help with a real problem, with a real conundrum. And when you find an explanation that seems to smooth over things too quickly, it's like, well, what am I doing here? So, you know, the Jewish Study Bible is great because the history of Judaism has had traditionally less difficulty with dealing bluntly with some problems. And, you know, I like reading the notes to Exodus and then hearing them say things like, yeah, Moses says this here, but he contradicts himself in Deuteronomy, you know, which is, you know, the fact is that there are these kinds of theological tensions in the Pentateuch and to have them addressed is a good idea.
So just to recap, because there were a lot of letters thrown around there. So Study Bible bases the studies and everything on a certain translation. Mm-hmm. So you could have some study Bibles that use the NIV version or other versions. So the ones that you gave, Pete, almost all of them, except for the Jewish Study Bible, which uses what we call the JPS version of the Bible, which is a Jewish translation, the rest use the NRSV, which you have, I think, said on the podcast is kind of your preferred translation. It's what you would use primarily.
Yeah. I mean, it's my preferred translation. I mean, I think almost any translation is fine, but I just found that to have less baggage than others, but it's by no means perfect, but it's fine. I think all translations work well. But these study Bibles are really good because of the notes, and I just love crisp maps. It just gives you a feel for where towns are and distances and charts of kings and, you know, lists of parables and cross references, you know, where else this phrase is used in the Bible and things like that. And also, you know, probably the biggest plus of these study Bibles that I mentioned are the fact that they all have essays in the back. And I mean, a lot of them, like 100 pages of essays. And, you know, I tell my students that it's sort of like getting a seminary education for about $30 or $40 because there's a lot of stuff packed into these. And just taking a year or two and finding a good study Bible. And I mean, I do this. I do this right during the summer, during the morning. What I do is I'm reading through right now the New Interpreter Study Bible, and I'm reading a chapter and then I'll read the notes. Then I'll read another chapter and read the notes just to remind myself of some of the issues. And it's very rewarding. And I think it's a great question because it's a very, very good way of benefiting from the work of scholars who do this stuff all the time and who are already bringing it into the lives of normal people who just want to read the Bible.
Well, and I think to maybe answer a question that wasn't asked, but is sort of behind this question and the last, and that is, you mentioned it, not to underestimate the work that it takes. I mean, it's a book. So there's just an undeniable amount of work that has to go into it. You have to know how to read, just in general, and you have to know how to read well. And that can be a lifelong pursuit of things like genre and how do you read ancient texts and how do they apply to today. And the fact too that you mentioned maps and there's all these places and there's all these names and it can be overwhelming. But I think it's important. Like, I think you and I have had experiences, maybe bad experiences, of sort of trains of thought that said you could short circuit that. And, you know, no, you don't need to do all that to really understand the Bible. You can have this immediate experience or these other things. And I think that's just a dangerous way. I mean, I don't think I would want to underestimate. Yeah, it takes work. That's why we go to congregations every Sunday to learn and why we have study Bibles. And it does. It just takes work.
Yeah, I mean, the Bible is not easy. I don't mind saying that. It's you know, it is a book for everyone, but part of the lie that our one questioner is, I think, you know, what he's been affected by is, you know, the lie that this book is plain and obvious and doesn't take much effort to understand. And we always have to remember how foreign and distant and ancient this book is. Yeah, but it's God's word. Okay, yeah, but it's God's word in a historical particular setting that is nothing like ours. And it does take work, and study Bibles are helpful. And it's not just modern people who did that, but people, you know, for hundreds of years in Christianity and Judaism have been looking at things like context to try to understand these things better. And, you know, who do we think we are if we can avoid that? You know, I mean, and why would we want to? You know, because there's so much that you can understand about this stuff. And, you know, there's nothing like understanding sort of what a Pharisee is and then trying to understand these dialogues in the Gospels. You know, it's there's nothing like trying to, you know, getting some insight into who the Assyrians were in the Old Testament and then reading these prophetic oracles that mention the Assyrians and like, oh, I see the point here. The Assyrians were horrible people, you know, or looking at ancient creation stories and then reading Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. It's enlightening. It's actually helpful. And it can be like, For a lot of people, I know it's actually life-giving because, like, this makes the Bible interesting because it has a context. And there's nothing like a good study Bible to do that succinctly, right? You don't have to read long commentaries. You don't have to read tons of books unless you have time. But just having a good study Bible, I think, takes care of so many of those problems. And you know, if you get ambitious, then you can sort of branch out from that too. But for the most part, just a good study Bible for the average Bible reader is a great idea.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung nur 3,49 €. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 €. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
We're sorry to interrupt the podcast, but we want to take just 1 minute to mention two simple ways to support the work we do with the Bible for Normal People. One, just go to iTunes, rate us, and give us a review, but only do it if you like us. If not, just remember this is the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Two, if you haven't already, please check us out on Patreon. patreon.com/thebiblefornormalpeople. There you'll find ways to join the community, contribute to the discussion, and offer your support at various levels. Last but not least, we want to give our deepest thanks to some of the members of our producers group. These folks not only email us feedback, but they jump on calls quarterly and have supported us financially. So thanks to Ryan Morrison, Michelle Chantos, Dave Carlton, Kevin Ming, Teresa Thompson, Philip Gibson, Lelia Fry, Stephen Goulstone, John Thomas, and Michelle Casey. We couldn't do what we do without you, so thank you. Now back to the podcast. That's a good segue, talking about the difficulties in understanding the Bible. The next question from Phyllis, maybe we should just stick with first names.
Let's do the first names.
That's easy.
I'll remember first name easier.
So, Phyllis, and maybe I think maybe it's appropriate to just read this, said, I recently heard a widow say she missed her late husband terribly, but she had assurance that everything came her way was a present from God. Further discussion led to the topic of God controlling or allowing everything, from death to sickness, droughts, elections, etc. Because of the hardships I have faced, I no longer believe this doctrine. In fact, I feel it makes God appear cruel. So can you help me on this?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's it's one that, people have been wrestling with a really long time. So I'm going to turn it over to Pete, who's going to answer it.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, the thing is, this is above my pay grade. I can just give my opinion that, you know, Phyllis, I think I agree with you. I don't think that God causes or controls directly everything that happens. You know, I don't think that's what this is about. I do think that human beings have responsibility and freedom. And I know this comes up an awful lot, especially with people who have had tragic experiences. And, you know, it's comforting to say, you know, I know that God was in this and God caused my infant to die or took my husband or wife away from me. And this is part of God's will. But I'm not sure if we really have the right to say that. See, what the gospel says, in my opinion, isn't that it's okay, God controls all those things, and whatever happens is God's will, and don't question it. I think it's more a matter of God enters human suffering, and that's what the cross is about. It's about God taking part in human suffering, and that doesn't answer the question of why things happen, but it does at least open up a whole different way of thinking about it, where God participates and understands human suffering. But, you know, this is the mystery of theology. This has been around. This is before Judaism and this is before the Israelites. These are things that the ancient Mesopotamians were writing about. And, you know, the technical word is theodicy, you know, defending God. Why would God do this? Why would a God who's all good and all powerful let these things happen? You know, and that is a conundrum that's been a part of the religious life of pretty much anybody for literally thousands of years. You know, and as I mean, I don't want to sort of give a cheap defense of Christianity or something, but it is the faith that I know of, at least, that tries to address that, but in a different kind of way, again, by God's participation in suffering through Christ and not giving a philosophical answer, but more something deeper and meatier and experiential.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an honest way of looking at that. The other side for me is where I've wrestled is also letting people be where they need to be. And I don't know if that's appropriate or not, but you know, there are a lot of people who are going through really tough times, and sort of what gets them through is this belief that things will work out. So it's always balancing that for some people, not that makes it right or wrong. Again, I think what we're saying is we don't really know. It's above our pay grade here on how all this stuff works. But again, I think just making sure that we're thinking through how to be wise, how do we navigate this world in which we don't understand everything, and being careful how we talk about that with other people, because I have my own experiences of sort of coming to this conclusion that God's not in charge of any of that. And then I think, you know, maybe derailing some people in a way that wasn't maybe helpful in my journey. So, but yeah, I would agree that we just don't know. Can we say anything else about that?
Well, I think, yeah, a couple of things, because it's such a big and important topic. But I appreciate the force of the question, too, like about God controlling or allowing everything from death to sickness, droughts, elections, etc. See, here's the thing, and this is where the Bible, you can never escape the Bible and engaging with and interacting with it. All those things, you could argue, are exactly the things the Bible talks about. That God causes death, that God causes sickness and droughts and famine and disease and war, pestilence and all those things. And God controls elections, well, not really, because there were no elections back then, but when you look at Romans chapter 13, verse 1 and 2, I guess, where, you know, all governing authorities are ordained by God. But even there, I think we have to just take a step back and not say, well, I'm not going to listen to those Bible passages, but to try to understand, back to the earlier question, something of the context in which these things were spoken, right? And this gets us into all sorts of deep stuff about just the nature of the Bible and the nature of God. When biblical writers talk about God causing the death of one's enemies so you can take their land, is that something that God, that really describes God? Or is that the way ancient Israelites living in a tribal society would have understood God? I just said a mouthful, and it's a lot to process. But you see, I think this is where this goes very, very quickly, There are all sorts of things in the Bible that reflect a given point in time, and we have to do what Jared said, is to be wise and to think through together, not just individually, but together, okay, what do we do with this information? In other words, do all governing authorities, are they all ordained by God? Not to sound ridiculous, but what about Hitler? What about Stalin? What about people who mean you no good? I mean, that's an easy thing to sort of quote when your favorite person is in the White House, but when he's not, then you ignore that, right? And the thing is, Paul didn't always follow that advice either, because he was in constant trouble with the Roman authorities for proclaiming Jesus, right? So the question is, why is Paul doing what he's doing in the book of Romans? Well, we can't get into that, but I think there are contextual reasons for encouraging this body of believers that may already be not getting along with each other, living in a city that already has a track record of an emperor tossing Jews out, and they just recently came back, where Paul might be saying, let's not make waves or cause trouble right now, because strategically, we have the potential here to influence the world with the church being in this nerve center called Rome. So, I mean, in other words, there were contextual reasons for why Paul might have said what he said. But to use that as a blanket statement, I mean, we wouldn't have our country. What we do is rebel against authorities, you know? So anyway, yeah.
Well, and to bring it back to the question about what, you know, Pete said, theodicy, defending God, or other people maybe call it the problem of evil, just to articulate maybe the problem for some people who haven't really thought about this too much, is I think I first heard about this because I read a long time ago, I might have been a teenager, I don't know when it came out, but Rabbi Kushner's book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he sets it up really nicely. Not that I necessarily even remember what his kind of solution was, but his premise is, how do we account for bad things, or how do we account for evil if God is all good or all loving, is all powerful and all knowing? So it seems like his point in that book is something seems like it's got to give. If God is all powerful and all knowing and all loving, it seems like he could have done something about this evil. And yet here we are, we have evil and we have bad things that happen all the time. So how do we account for that? So that's really at the root of that question that goes back, as you said, Pete, all the way back to Mesopotamian times, early Greek times. Most major civilizations and religions have had to wrestle with this at some level. So,
and it's more difficult if you're a monotheist. If you're a polytheist, you can always blame it on one god,
blame it on the other god,
and you have to get some other god on your side to do battle with him or her. But when you have one god, see, now the problem becomes even more acute.
So it's our two-party system in America is a way to deal with the problem of evil, right?
Yeah, right.
We just blame it on the other side.
Blame it on the other party. Right. But, you know, in religion, this is such an interesting topic, but one reason why you have an increase in divine activity in Judaism a couple hundred years or so before the time of Christ is because, you know, the Jews became more strongly convicted of a monotheism, but then you had to have a Satan figure, also called, you know, Belial and some other names, and you had a more active divine angelic realm, and you had a lot of activity in there because, you know, even though God is ultimately in charge, to have a bad divine creature of some sort takes a little bit of the heat off. Right. And, you know, that's why, you know, we can't find our car keys. We blame Satan. That's a little ridiculous. But, you know, it's easy to sort of blame someone else for why truly bad things happen. It beats laying it on God's, you know, lap. But it's not that easy. You know, it's a difficult, difficult problem. And again, for me, the only answer that I can think of is not really an answer, but it's just a perspective, which is Christianity is the only religion I know of where God participates in human suffering somehow and recognizes it and doesn't fix it, but also, you know, rises above it. So it's not that, you know, God allow, if, you know, if you believe in God enough, bad things won't happen to you, because they clearly do, right? But it's like no matter what happens, the Spirit of God is with you and is aware of your suffering. You know, again, that doesn't answer the question, but it's almost like the best that I can do, mm-hmm. You know.
And on the conceptual level too, you know, a lot of work has been done in what's called like open theism or process theology around the nature between control and love And if God is loving, is that God capable of control?
What are those things? Open theism.
Yeah, so open theism. We'll just stick with open theism because it's a little easier to get into than process theology. But just the understanding that maybe God doesn't know or control the future. And so what happens? Because now it's interesting because it's not just philosophical or out there, but the Bible itself presents God as coming to know things or regretting things. Oftentimes, especially in the Old Testament, God's presented as being surprised by things, which means maybe God didn't know the future in that context. So in some ways, this idea, I remember when this idea first came out in evangelicalism with Clark Pinnock, mm-hmm. maybe. Yeah. And I remember him saying, like, well, I'm trying to read the Bible and what it says, and it seems like God doesn't know the future. And so this open theism comes out of that, where that is one possible route that a lot of scholars are going and trying to understand some of this. So
I guess the open part means
the future is open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not determined. It's open, and God doesn't control the future and stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, whatever you think of that, it's an attempt to solve a problem.
Right.
It's a theology that's trying to wrap its arms around something and give some sort of a coherent answer. But at the very least, we should avoid the cheap answers of like, well, God controls all this because God's sovereign and God does everything. I think, you know, a moment's reflection and hanging out with people who have suffered a lot might, like our questioner, like Phyllis, you know, that melts away pretty quickly. And it's and then you right away you find yourself in a conversation that's been going on for literally millennia.
Yeah.
And welcome. You know, it's here you are.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam. Und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem. Mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn. Und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Yeah, you every time, I mean, just on all the reading I've done on it, it's like you think you solve one problem by coming up with a solution, and it really just creates several more problems. And so that humility, and you know, you mentioned it, Pete, I think just the wisdom for me is understanding that these things are deeply personal and painful for a lot of people, and we can't just theorize about it and say, oh, let's just have this heady conversation about whether God's in control, when people were actually suffering and in the midst of that suffering. And in that way, the biblical portrayal, as you said, is in some ways the wisest way, or at least maybe one of the most loving ways, which is just to sit in the suffering, mm-hmm. to participate in it, and not always try to answer it or right. solve it.
Right.
So. Yeah. All right, well, not to get kind of whiplash, but the next question takes us a little different direction. And it comes from Kelly, who just asks, could we talk about the significance of baptism?
Could we?
I think we can.
Yeah, significance for what, I guess? I mean, what it means, you know?
This is like such a cynical way to start.
I know, but significance.
Significance for what? What are we going to talk about? It's not significant. Okay, end of story. Done. Yeah.
No, I mean, my kids are baptized, and I like the idea because it's a sign, I think, it's a sign of God's presence in a family. That's why I'm an advocate of infant baptism. I don't think it's wrong, but I understand people who don't agree with that. That's fine with me, too. One of my kids was baptized as an infant and as a 14-year-old because the first one didn't take, so she had to do it again.
Yeah, she must have been really bad.
Bad parents. But, you know, it's all that is fine with me. You know, I don't really have a big theological stake in when you're baptized, but I think it is a sign of cleansing and of connection to God. And it's not something that saves you, although in the New Testament you have language like that. But again, the context is different. There you have adults who are proclaiming Christ and participating in a visible ceremony. you know, by which they are saved because they're, you know, connected to Jesus at that point. But you don't really have, you know, and how do you raise your kids now? You know, it's just, it's a different moment in time. And, you know, the question of baptism, its significance, that's something that theologians have had to think about subsequent to that. Like, you know, that it's a different kind of question in the opening moments of the church than it is 2,000 years later.
Yeah, so I think I had a major shift on this. When I was a pastor, we had a, this would have been, I don't even know what year it is, so this would have been more than 10 years ago, we had a gay couple come and want to be baptized. And so, you know, we got, and we had about five or six of us pastors at the church, is a large church. And so we had a brainstorm of like, what do? We have a gay couple that want to be, okay. So we thought, yeah, we can baptize them. That's good. That's fine. So we did that. And it's sort of like, okay, welcome to God's family. That's great. And then like 2 months later, they wanted to be members of the church. And we had this brainstorm again. And for me, it was like one of those definite light bulb moments where I was like, well, of course, like we just welcome into God's family. Are we going to now be like, oh yeah, but we're a little, our rules are a little stricter than God. But that's actually how it turned out. And they were like, well, we baptize them, but they can't be members of the church. And so that just shifted my understanding of baptism, where I think we're afraid of baptism, in at least in my tradition, we were a little afraid of it because it was saying like, you're in, like it would, like you said, it's like this sign that you're now part of God's family, and family is forever. Like, when you're in, you're in. Like, you're blood. Like, I didn't choose my kids, and I can not talk to them. That doesn't make them not my kids. Mm-hmm. And so I think we almost neuter that significance, or we make it less valuable because we're scared of what it means. Like, well, what happens if people go out and they just are crazy and heretics and do their own thing after this? So it's almost like we make this contingency and we add things to it, like church membership, mm-hmm. like something we can control. Like, well, you can be a part of God's family for your whole life, but we're going to make it harder on you to be a part of this family. So anyway, it cheapened it for me a little bit. So I think for me, the significance, you know, you mentioned infant baptism. I was born and raised a Southern Baptist. So we were, you know, immersion. When you say that prayer of salvation, that's when you get baptized. And that experience when I was a pastor helped me to realize like, no, this is about a symbol of being part of God's family. Mm-hmm. And it took on a deeper significance to me and made me also question this idea of who's in and who's out, mm-hmm. and who gets to make that distinction. So,
and speaking of immersion, you want to get into a fight with some Christians, talk about the mode of baptism. But, you know, in my opinion, in the New Testament, it's absolutely immersion because it's symbolic of dying and then rising.
And that, for those of you who are very uninitiated, that just means you get dunked all the way under the water.
Right. Yeah. Like out there in a creek or something. Or if your church has a swimming pool in the front, which a lot of them do, that's you go under, and it is symbolic of dying to yourself and mm-hmm. rising to new life in Christ. It is symbolic of that. And I think symbols are very important, which is why I think, you know, baptism is a great thing to
do.
And
if you don't live in Pennsylvania, a crick is a creek.
Yeah. A crick. Yeah. But here's the thing. Then the theological question arose in the church. What about kids? You don't dunk a newborn, right? Well, then you shouldn't baptize them. Yeah, but you know, this is, and I appreciate this, this is how Calvinists argue about this, and I think they make a very fair point that in the Old Testament, children are part of the covenant family through the males by means of circumcision. So if circumcision is a sign of the Old Covenant and it's very inclusive, why would the New Covenant be less inclusive? Why don't you baptize infants as a sign of their participation in the covenant family? Of course, they always make up their own minds, just like Israelites did when they got older. That's not the point. It's not a once saved, always saved thing, but it's a symbol of being a part of a family. You know, I remember when our oldest, our son, he was in preschool and, you know, we were trying to raise our kids as semi-Christian somehow, you know, and whatever that meant. But I remember him going and asking, you know, his mom, you know, what is God like, right? Which is, you know, a wonderful question for a four-year-old to ask. But I remember visiting his preschool, and there was a wonderful girl, one of his friends, would say, oh my God, about, oh my God, look at that. Oh, look at that. Oh my God. It was, oh my God, oh my God. It's like, and she's four, and of course, she's getting that from home. And I don't mean that in a judgmental sense, but the thing is that what struck me then is that baptism is a sign that the child is in a different environment. And I think, to me, that's very important. That's why, you know, I my granddaughter was just dedicated. I'm fine with that. It's wonderful. But I think a difference between dedication and baptism is you dedicate someone in the hopes that one day they will be part of the family of God. I think baptism is stronger than that. It's that you already are. Now, life happens and you'll have to make decisions and whatever, but you have a different starting point than others. And I hold on to there's a sacredness to that, you know, even with adult children, I still hold on to that there's something about that that's not mystical or magical, but still meaningful.
Well, and it comes back to, I think, tradition and symbols we were taught not to put any significance in those. Everything was about personal decision and then sort of reading the Bible in a moral way to live a good life. And so, yeah, so I had to reconstruct as I got older how to have any of those things mean anything. Communion, all these things, like my tradition took them very seriously, but they sort of gutted all the reasons why you would take it really seriously, which was always confusing to me. Like, we got really solemn and it became this really important thing that we then ate a cracker and a juice. And then my pastor would go out of his way to make sure I knew that, well, that's just a symbol. It's not really anything significant. Well, then why are we like hush hush and like somber, and it becomes this thing? We were in a bit of a crisis, I think, as a faith tradition, where we didn't know exactly how to make this mean anything anymore. And only as I got older and talk about ritual and talk about meaning and inclusion in a family and how that can be symbolic, that I kind of learned how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody, thanks for listening to our first Q&A. There'll be many more. We had fun doing this. And as always, we're thankful to those of you we're thankful for all of you, yeah, but especially to those of you who support us at Patreon and visit us on the website and engage with us. We have a lot of fun creating this community, and we're grateful for all of you.
Yeah, and just to ask for your participation more, if you do have other questions, we make no guarantees that it will ever be here on the podcast or that we will ever respond to them. But if you wanted to submit questions, feel free to do that. Again, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com. Is it its own page? They can click on Ask Pete.
Ask Pete, yeah.
And you click on that, you answer some questions, sign away the rights to your firstborn child, and voila, we have the questions in our inbox. So feel free to do that. We love to get those questions. We want to know what questions you're asking, and we get questions that cause us to think about things in a new way.
All right, folks. Thanks again.
See you next time.